When the Australian Labor Party turned 100 back in 1991, one of the ways the centenary was marked was with the publication of a commissioned history by our next guest, Ross McMullen. It was called The Light on the Hill, the Australian Labor Party 1891 to 1991. And while for Labor supporters the light's still on the hill, of course, a lot of water has gone under the bridge since that year. So, in 2026, Ross McMullen is releasing a new edition of The Light on the Hill. Ross describes the book as telling the story of Australia's oldest and most resilient and significant political party through the people who shaped it. A former cabinet minister in the Keating, Rudd and Gillard governments, John Faulkner, is quoted on the cover calling it a Labor history without peer. The new chapter of The Light on the Hill covers the years 1991 to 2024, so that's 33 years in 40 pages, which gives you a sense of the scale of the challenge. But the man who's done it is Ross McMullen, and he joins us on Sunday Extra now. Welcome, Ross.
Good morning, Julian.
Ross, the book is a commissioned history. Out of interest, in the second edition, what editorial constraints, if any, does that place on your work?
It was commissioned initially in the 1980s for the 1991 centenary history, but this time round, I initiated it.
Aha.
I said, what about expanding it? And the ALP said, yes, go for your life. And so I did.
You frame the new edition with the victory of the Albanese government at the last election. And one of the questions you ask is, has there ever been a more spectacular triumph in the Australian Labor Party's long history? If we were to ask ourselves that question now, Ross, what are the contenders for Labor's most spectacular win? And what's your verdict on which Labor victory wins?
The standout ones are 1910, 1943, and last year. 1972 and 93 were special, but 72, Gough was expected to win, and Keating's upset in 1993 was fantastic, but I think the other three are just ahead of them. 1910, we've forgotten all this, but early on, Australian Labor was leading the world, and this was spectacularly confirmed with the 1910 election. It's forgotten now that the first 10 years of federal politics, no one had a majority throughout that decade in the lower or upper house, and yet Labor broke through in 1910 with such a spectacular win that they had very good majorities in both houses. So that was pretty special. 1943, Curtin won a marvellous victory during World War II at the time when he was leading the country in a way that was perceived as very high standard. And then last year's election, I reckon, comes second to 1943. The way I rate them is that 1943 had a slightly higher proportion of the lower house seats that Labor ended up winning, which puts it slightly ahead of last year. But the thing about last year that was so special was that it was such a transformation from what was expected not long earlier. I mean, you had Nikki Sava saying not long before that Albo should think about retiring. And even if Labor manages somehow to scrape home, he should retire anyway. Now, what happened instead of that was the second largest proportion of lower house seats ever won by the Labor Party in the entire history of Australian federal politics. An extraordinary turnaround.
The new chapter covers the years 1991 to 2024, and one of the dominant themes is the impact of showdowns in the federal leadership. You start with the transition from Hawke to Keating, and of course, the toxic leadership ructions between Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard were the dominant theme of the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years. Looking with the historian's perspective, how do you compare those two leadership showdowns, Ross?
Well, I think the key difference was the unexpectedness of the change from Rudd to Gillard. To the average political follower, other than sort of inside specialists, or even to inside specialists, this sort of happened out of nowhere. There was this overnight transformation and run-on in terms of support that suddenly emerged for Gillard, and Rudd, as a result, resigned in caucus the next morning. The average elector had no idea of what was coming. The contrast with Hawke and Keating, of course, is that Keating had already challenged 6 months earlier, very public, he'd been on telly saying why Caucus should pick him, and there was a rerun 6 months later.
You describe the Gillard challenge to Kevin Rudd's leadership as one day of upheaval that blighted the Federal Labor Party for more than a decade. I think it's fair to say that overall your analysis places more blame on Julia Gillard than Kevin Rudd. Why do you think that really responsibility for that decade runs with Julia Gillard when many of the internal accounts of the first Rudd government were that it had become extremely dysfunctional?
It's very important for the historian, as I see it, to remain even-handed. So when writing about events within the ALP, it's important that the story doesn't feel like it's written by some kind of factional warrior. And my treatment of the Gillard-Rudd challenge is very much consistent with that. What I would say, though, is that Gillard herself and a lot of her supporters kept using the word spontaneous. Bill Shorten used the word spontaneous about how the whole thing erupted, which is what it seemed to do as far as political observers were concerned. It happened overnight. But in actual fact, I found once looking into it that I didn't think it was quite as spontaneous as those Gillard activists claimed. There'd been things happening in the lead up to it. You know, people like Ferguson was saying how Gillard, a few days before this all erupted, he was saying that Gillard kept prodding him about the leadership, and someone had been writing a speech in Gillard's office about becoming Prime Minister, I think weeks before. So there's various things like that that make you, when you look into it, wonder whether it was as 100% spontaneous as some people were claiming.
You also quote former Labor Senator Kim Carr as describing the Rudd-Gillard conflict as tantamount to another party split, referring, of course, to the terrible divisions within the Labor Party in previous generations and the split with the DLP. How do you compare those two periods of division?
I think Kim Carr has good reason for saying what he concluded there. It's had such ongoing divisiveness that the word split is understandable. And even though there've been some earlier ones that were very, very fierce and bitter, I'm talking here about the conscription split in World War One, the split in the Scullin government during the Depression, and of course the one in the 1950s that led to the DLP. They were incredibly bitter controversies, and the fact that anyone would compare the Rudd-Gillard controversy with them as a split says a lot about it, but it is valid because the divisiveness lingered so long and was so influential.
On Sunday Extra, we are speaking with Ross McMullen about his new Light on the Hill, the updated history of the Australian Labor Party. And Ross, one of the things that struck me as interesting about the new chapter is the relative prominence of Jenny Macklin. Why does Jenny Macklin have such prominence in the new chapter?
Well, I think she deserves to be treated in the way that I have. I mean, she was deputy leader for an extended period, and many sources emphasise how important she was. The books by Rudd and Gillard and the key senior cabinet minister, Greg Combe, all emphasise how important Jenny Macklin was, and so too do the biographies of Tanya Plibersek and Penny Wong, where she's also highlighted as being incredibly influential.
Could you remind us of the contributions that Jenny Macklin made, particularly in government, that are the real core of why she has such a prominent role?
It was mainly as an influential policy contributor. We're talking here about things like the Rudd apology to the Stolen Generations, and Rudd himself said without her it could not have succeeded. Jenny Macklin was delighted when her toil culminated in the Paid Parental Leave Act, which was a landmark reform she chased for 13 years. And her other wide-ranging policy contributions include the biggest pension increase for a century, additional payments to pensioners as part of the GFC stimulus package, and also benefits associated with the introduction of carbon pricing, tax cuts, further pension increases, other assistance to households, and she was immersed in reform affecting access to poker machines. And she was also crucial in the government's response to the devastating Black Saturday bushfires, not only financial relief for victims, but also recovery activities. And if I haven't mentioned the NDIS, I should also, because she was involved in that as well. So, yeah, she was very influential.
As you indicate in the preface, a part of the purpose of the new edition of The Light on the Hill is to communicate the breadth and depth of the history of the Australian Labor Party to a new generation. There might be some members of newer generations who are surprised to learn or be reminded that the former leader of One Nation in the New South Wales Upper House, Mark Latham, was for a time the leader of the Australian Labor Party and the opposition. And when Latham came to power after 8 years of the Labor Party being run by the sons of Whitlam ministers, he was indeed the second youngest leader after Chris Watson. You probably couldn't get a stronger contrast between Labor leaders than Chris Watson and Mark Latham. And I know you've written a whole book on Chris Watson, Ross. Could you give us your overview reflections of Labor's two youngest leaders?
Yes, they could hardly be more unalike in personal style, could they? Latham was seen as a young hopeful, and interestingly, you know, Jenny Macklin was his deputy. And people don't know about Watson, Julian, but
it was an extraordinary life.
He's extraordinary, though little known today. He's the first leader of the Federal Labor Party, the first Labor Prime Minister, the third Australian Prime Minister. He'd been prominent in the 1890s debates about the structure of this new Labor Party formed in 1891. You know, how should we differentiate ourselves with the other parties? And these debates went on through the 1890s, and he's very involved in them. And I keep finding it absolutely staggering that at the age of 25, he's chairing these fiery conferences and debates in the roles of both chair of the New South Wales ALP and president of the union movement in New South Wales. He's 25, Julian. I mean, how extraordinary is he?
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he is the only Australian Prime Minister who was born in Chile.
Correct. Yes. Yes, he is.
Ross, the task that you've taken on in The Light of the Hill is a massive one, and you describe it as aiming to be both comprehensive and accurate, but also readable and accessible. What are the hardest challenges of achieving both those things? Because you have so much material to work with, even more so in the contemporary times, presumably, because you've got all sorts of records that you have to go over. How hard was it producing the new chapter and distilling Labor's history into the substantial book that you have created once again?
Yes, well, it is challenging. I guess what I try and do routinely is to find out first what happened, and then the next stage is telling the story as well as you can. And for me, flow is a priority. So carrying the reader along with storytelling that's as good as you can make it. And another element with this project in particular is even-handedness when writing about ALP events. And I referred to that earlier about, you know, Rudd Gillard. That is, within the ALP, it's important that the story doesn't feel like it's being written by some kind of factional warrior, which I'm not. Of course, from the ALP looking elsewhere, as far as anti-Labor's concerned, naturally the approach is different. You know, the perspective of the ALP and the rank and file members, their perspective of identities like Abbott and Howard leading their governments is, of course, critical, and the book reflects this. So it's even-handed within the ALP, but it reflects ALP identities, perspectives of other parties outside the ALP.
Ross McMullen, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much, Julian.
That's Ross McMullen. And his 2026 edition of The Light on the Hill is the updated history of the Australian Labor Party, bringing us all the way through from 1891 to 2025.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.